She had never looked at him. He said, in a faint, desperate voice, "I reckon I don't want no coffee." For a while, she did not move. Then one of the big hands moved and took up the coffee cup. Hand and cup vanished. He sat still, down looking too, waiting. Then it came. It was not the proprietor. It was the woman behind the cigar case. "What's that?" she said. "He don't want the coffee," the waitress said. Her voice, speaking, moved on as if she had not paused at the question. Her voice was flat, quiet. The other woman's voice was quiet, too. "Didn't he order coffee, too?" she said. "No," the waitress said, in that level voice that was still in motion, going away. "I misunderstood." When he got out, when his spirit, wrung with abasement and regret and passionate for hiding, scuttled past the cold face of the woman behind the cigar case, he believed that he knew he would and could never see her again. He did not believe that he could bear to see her again, even look at the street, the dingy doorway, even from a distance again, not thinking yet, "It's terrible to be young. It's terrible. Terrible." When Saturdays came, he found, invented reasons to decline to go to town, with McEachern watching him, though not with actual suspicion yet. He passed the days by working hard, too hard. McEachern contemplated the work with suspicion. But there was nothing which the man could know, deduce. Working was permitted him. Then he could get the nights past, since he would be too tired to lie awake. And in time even the despair and the regret and the shame grew less. He did not cease to remember it, to react to it. But now it had become worn out, like a gramophone record. Familiar only because of the worn threading which blurred the voices. After a while, even McEachern accepted a fact. He said, "I have been watching you lately, and now there is nothing for it but I must misdoubt my own eyes or else believe that at last you are beginning to accept what the Lord has seen fit to allot you. But I will not have you grow vain because I have spoken well of it. You'll have time and opportunity, and inclination too, I don't doubt, to make me regret that I have spoken. To fall into sloth and idleness again. However, reward was created for man the same as chastisement. Do you see that heifer yonder? From today, that calf is your own. See that I do not later regret it." Joe thanked him. Then he could look at the calf and say aloud, "That belongs to me." Then he looked at it, and it was again too fast and too complete to be thinking, "That is not a gift. It is not even a promise. It is a threat." Thinking, "I didn't ask for it. He gave it to me. I didn't ask for it." Believing, "God knows I have earned it." It was a month later. It was Saturday morning. "I thought you did not like town anymore," McEachern said. "I reckon one more trip won't hurt me," Joe said. He had a half dollar in his pocket. Mrs. McEachern had given it to him. He had asked for a nickel. She insisted that he take the half dollar. He took it, holding it on his palm, cold, contemptuously. "I suppose not," McEachern said. "You have worked hard, too. But town is no good habit for a man who has yet to make his way." He did not need to escape, though he would have, even by violence, perhaps. But McEachern made it easy. He went to the restaurant, fast. He entered without stumbling now. The waitress was not there. Perhaps he saw, noticed that she wasn't. He stopped at the cigar counter, behind which the woman sat, laying the half dollar on the counter. I owe a nickel. For a cup of coffee. I said pie and coffee before I knew that pie was a dime. I owe you a nickel. He did not look toward the rear. The men were there, in their slanted hats and with their cigarettes. The proprietor was there. Waiting, Joe heard him at last, in the dirty apron, speaking past the cigarette. What is it? What does he want? He says he owes Bobby a nickel, the woman said. He wants to give Bobby a nickel. Her voice was quiet. The proprietor's voice was quiet. Well, for Christ's sake, he said. To Joe, the room was full of listening. He heard, not hearing. He saw, not looking. He was now moving toward the door. The half dollar lay on the glass counter. Even from the rear of the room, the proprietor could see it, since he said, What's that for? He says he owes for a cup of coffee, the woman said. Joe had almost reached the door. Here, Jack, the man said. Joe did not stop. Give him his money, the man said, flat-voiced, not yet moving. The cigarette smoke would curl still across his face, unwinded by any movement. Give it back to him, the man said. I don't know what his racket is, but he can't work it here. Give it back to him. You better go back to the farm, Hiram. Maybe you can make a girl there with a nickel. Now he was in the street, sweating the half dollar, the coin sweating his hand, larger than a cartwheel feeling. He walked in laughter. He had passed through the door upon it, upon the laughing of the men. It swept and carried him along the street. Then it began to flow past him, dying away, letting him to earth, pavement. He and the waitress were facing one another. She did not see him at once, walking swiftly, down-looking, in a dark dress and a hat. Again, stopped, she did not even look at him, having already looked at him, all-seeing, like when she had set the coffee and the pie on the counter. She said, Oh, and you come back to give it to me. Before them. And they kidded you. Well, say. I thought you might have had to pay for it yourself. I thought, Well, say. Can you tie that? Can you now? They were not looking at one another, standing face to face. To another they must have looked like two monks met during the hour of contemplation in a garden path. I just thought that I... Where do you live? She said. In the country? Well, say. What's your name? It's not McEachern, he said. It's Christmas. Christmas? Is that your name? Christmas? Well, say. On the Saturday afternoons, during and after adolescence, he and the other four or five boys hunted and fished. He saw girls only at church on Sunday. They were associated with Sunday and with church, so he could not notice them. To do so would be, even to him, a retraction of his religious hatred. But he and the other boys talked about girls. Perhaps some of them, the one who arranged with the Negro girl that afternoon, for instance, knew. They all want to, he told the others. But sometimes they can't. The others did not know that. They did not know that all girls wanted to, let alone that there were times when they could not. They thought differently. But to admit that they did not know the latter would be to admit that they had not discovered the former. So they listened while the boy told them. It's something that happens to them once a month. He described his idea of the physical ceremony. Perhaps he knew. Anyway, he was graphic enough, convincing enough. If he had tried to describe it as a mental state, something which he only believed they would not have listened. But he drew a picture, physical, actual, to be discerned by the sense of smell and even of sight. It moved them. The temporary and abject helplessness of that which tantalized and frustrated desire, the smooth and superior shape in which volition dwelled, doomed to be at stated and inescapable intervals victims of periodical filth. That was how the boy told it, with the other five listening quietly, looking at one another, questioning and secret. On the next Saturday, Joe did not go hunting with them. McEachern thought that he had already gone since the gun was missing. But Joe was hidden in the barn. He stayed there all that day. On the Saturday following, he did go, but alone, early, before the boys called for him. But he did not hunt. He was not 3 miles from home when, in the late afternoon, he shot a sheep. He found the flock in a hidden valley and stalked and killed one with the gun. Then he knelt, his hands in the yet warm blood of the dying beast, trembling, dry-mouthed, back-glaring. Then he got over it, recovered. He did not forget what the boy had told him. He just accepted it. He found that he could live with it, side by side with it. It was as if he said, illogical and desperately calm, "All right. It is so, then. But not to me. Not in my life and my love." Then it was 3 or 4 years ago, and he had forgotten it, in the sense that a fact is forgotten when it once succumbs to the mind's insistence that it be neither true nor false. He met the waitress on the Monday night following the Saturday on which he had tried to pay for the cup of coffee. He did not have the rope then. He climbed from his window and dropped the 10 feet to the earth and walked the 5 miles into town. He did not think at all about how he would get back into his room. He reached town and went to the corner where she had told him to wait. It was a quiet corner, and he was quite early, thinking, "I will have to remember to let her show me what to do and how to do it and when. To not let her find out that I don't know, that I will have to find out from her." He had been waiting for over an hour when she appeared. He had been that early. She came up on foot. She came and stood before him, small, with that air steadfast, waiting, down-looking, coming up out of the darkness. "Here you are," she said. "I got here as soon as I could. I had to wait for them to go to sleep. I was afraid I would be late." "Have you been here long? How long?" "I don't know. I ran most of the way. I was afraid I would be late."
"You ran? All them 3 miles?"
"It's 5 miles. It's not three."
"Well, say."
Then they did not talk. They stood there, two shadows facing one another. More than a year later, remembering that night, he said, suddenly knowing, "It was like she was waiting for me to hit her."
"Well," she said.
He had begun now to tremble a little. He could smell her, smell the waiting. Still, wise, a little weary, thinking, "She's waiting for me to start, and I don't know how." Even to himself, his voice sounded idiotic. "I reckon it's late."
"Late?"
"I thought maybe they would be waiting for you. Waiting up until you..."
"Waiting for... waiting for..."
Her voice died, ceased. She said, not moving. They stood like two shadows. "I live with Mame and Max. You know, the restaurant. You ought to remember them, trying to pay that nickel." She began to laugh. There was no mirth in it, nothing in it. When I think of that, when I think of you coming in there with that nickel. Then she stopped laughing. There was no cessation of mirth in that either. The still, abject, down-looking voice reached him. I made a mistake tonight. I forgot something. Perhaps she was waiting for him to ask her what it was, but he did not. He just stood there, with the still, down-speaking voice dying somewhere about his ears. He had forgot about the shot sheep. He had lived with the fact which the older boy had told him too long now. With the slain sheep, he had bought immunity from it for too long now for it to be alive. So he could not understand at first what she was trying to tell him. They stood at the corner. It was at the edge of town, where the street became a road that ran on beyond the ordered and measured lawns, between small random houses and barren fields. The small, cheap houses which compose the purlieus of such towns. She said, "Listen, I'm sick tonight." He did not understand. He said nothing. Perhaps he did not need to understand. Perhaps he had already expected some fateful mischance, thinking it was too good to be true anyway. Thinking too fast for even thought, in a moment she will vanish. She will not be. And then I will be back home, in bed, not having left it at all. Her voice went on. I forgot about the day of the month when I told you Monday night. You surprised me, I guess. There on the street, Saturday. I forgot what day it was, anyhow, until after you had gone. His voice was as quiet as hers. How sick. Haven't you got some medicine at home that you can take? Haven't I got? Her voice died. She said, "Well, say." She said suddenly, "It's late, and you with 4 miles to walk." "I've already walked it now. I'm here now." His voice was quiet, hopeless, calm. "I reckon it's getting late," he said. Then something changed. Not looking at him, she sensed something before she heard it in his hard voice. "What kind of sickness have you got?" She didn't answer at once. Then she said, still, down-looking, "You haven't ever had a sweetheart yet." "I'll bet you haven't." He didn't answer. "Have you?" He didn't answer. She moved. She touched him for the first time. She came and took his arm, lightly, in both hands. Looking down, he could see the dark shape of the lowered head which appeared to have been set out of line a little on the neck when she was born. She told him, halting, clumsily, using the only words which she knew, perhaps. But he had heard it before. He had already fled backward, past the slain sheep, the price paid for immunity, to the afternoon when, sitting on a creek bank, he had been not hurt or astonished so much as outraged. The arm which she held jerked free. She did not believe that he had intended to strike her. She believed otherwise, in fact. But the result was the same. As he faded on down the road, the shape, the shadow, she believed that he was running. She could hear his feet for some time after she could no longer see him. She did not move at once. She stood as he had left her, motionless, down-looking, as though waiting for the blow which she had already received. He was not running. But he was walking fast, and in a direction that was taking him further yet from home, from the house 5 miles away which he had left by climbing from a window and which he had not yet planned any way of re-entering. He went on down the road fast and turned from it and sprang over a fence into plowed earth. Something was growing in the furrows, Beyond were woods, trees. He reached the woods and entered among the hard trunks, the branch shadowed, quiet, hard-feeling, hard-smelling, invisible. In the not-seeing and the hard-knowing, as though in a cave, he seemed to see a diminishing row of suavely shaped urns in moonlight, blanched. And not one was perfect. Each one was cracked, and from each crack there issued something liquid, death-colored and foul. He touched a tree, leaning his propped arms against it, seeing the ranked and moonlit urns. He vomited. On the next Monday night, he had the rope. He was waiting at the same corner. He was quite early again. Then he saw her. She came up to where he stood.
"I thought maybe you wouldn't be here," she said.
"Did you?" He took her arm, drawing her on down the road.
"Where are we going?" she said.
He didn't answer, drawing her on. She had to trot to keep up. She trotted clumsily, an animal impeded by that which distinguished her from animals. Her heels, her clothes, her smallness. He drew her from the road toward the fence which he had crossed a week ago.
"Wait," she said, the words jolting from her mouth. "The fence. I can't."
As she stooped to go through, between the strands of wire which he had stepped over, her dress caught. He leaned and jerked it free with a ripping sound. "I'll buy you another one," he said. She said nothing. She let herself be half-carried and half-dragged among the growing plants, the furrows, and into the woods, the trees. He kept the rope neatly coiled behind the same loose board in his attic room where Mrs. McEachern kept her hoard of nickels and dimes, with the difference that the rope was thrust further back into the hole than Mrs. McEachern could reach. He had got the idea from her. Sometimes, with the old couple snoring in the room beneath, when he lifted out the silent rope, he would think of the paradox. Sometimes he thought about telling her, of showing her where he kept hidden the implement of his sin, having got the idea, learned how and where to hide it from her. But he knew that she would merely want to help him conceal it, that she would want him to sin in order that she could help him hide it, that she would at last make such a to-do of meaningful whispers and signals that McEachern would have to suspect something despite himself. Thus he began to steal, to take money from the hoard. It is very possible that the woman did not suggest it to him, never mentioned money to him. It is possible that he did not even know that he was paying with money for pleasure. It was that he had watched for years Mrs. McEachern hide money in a certain place. Then he himself had something which it was necessary to hide. He put it in the safest place which he knew. Each time he hid or retrieved the rope, he saw the tin can containing money. The first time he took 50 cents. He debated for some time between 50 cents and a quarter. Then he took the 50 cents because that was the exact sum he needed. With it, he bought a stale and fly-specked box of candy from a man who had won it for 10 cents on a punching board in a store. He gave it to the waitress. It was the first thing which he had ever given her. He gave it to her as if no one had ever thought of giving her anything before. Her expression was a little strange when she took the tawdry, shabby box into her big hands. She was sitting at the time on her bed in her bedroom in the small house where she lived with the man and woman called Max and Mame. One night, about a week before, the man came into the room. She was undressing, sitting on the bed while she removed her stockings. He came in and leaned against the bureau, smoking. "A rich farmer," he said. "John Jacob Astor from the cowshed." She had covered herself, sitting on the bed, still, down-looking.
"He pays me."
"With what?"
Hasn't he used up that nickel yet? He looked at her. A setup for hayseeds. That's what I brought you down here from Memphis for. Maybe I'd better start giving away grub, too.
I'm not doing it on your time.
Sure. I can't stop you. I just hate to see you. A kid that never saw a whole dollar at one time in his life. With this town full of guys making good jack that would treat you right.
Maybe I like him. Maybe you hadn't thought of that.
He looked at her, at the still and lowered crown of her head as she sat on the bed, her hands on her lap. He leaned against the bureau, smoking. He said, "Mame?" After a while, he said again, "Mame, come in here." The walls were thin. After a while, the big blonde woman came up the hall without haste. They could both hear her. She entered. "Get this," the man said. "She says maybe she likes him best. It's Romeo and Juliet. For sweet Jesus." The blonde woman looked at the dark crown of the waitress's head.
"What about that?"
"Nothing. It's fine. Max Confrey presenting Miss Bobby Allen, the youth's companion."
"Go out," the woman said.
"Sure. I just brought her change for a nickel." He went out. The waitress had not moved. The blonde woman went to the bureau and leaned against it, looking at the other's lowered head.
"Does he ever pay you?" she said.
The waitress did not move.
"Yes, he pays me."
The blonde woman looked at her, leaning against the bureau as Max had done. "Coming all the way down here from Memphis? Bringing it all the way down here to give it away?" The waitress did not move.
"I'm not hurting Max."
The blonde woman looked at the other's lowered head. Then she turned and went toward the door. "See that you don't," she said. "This won't last forever. These little towns won't stand for this long. I know. I came from one of them." Sitting on the bed, holding the cheap, florid candy box in her hands, she sat as she had sat while the blonde woman talked to her. But it was now Joe who leaned against the bureau and looked at her. She began to laugh. She laughed, holding the gaudy box in her big knuckled hands. Joe watched her. He watched her rise and pass him, her face lowered. She passed through the door and called Max by name. Joe had never seen Max save in the restaurant, in the hat and the dirty apron. When Max entered, he was not even smoking. He thrust out his hand. "How are you, Romeo?" he said. Joe was shaking hands almost before he had recognized the man. "My name's Joe McEachern," he said. The blonde woman had also entered. It was also the first time he had ever seen her, save in the restaurant. He saw her enter, watching her, watching the waitress open the box. She extended it.
"Joe brought it to me," she said.
The blonde woman looked at the box once. She did not even move her hand. "Thanks," she said. The man also looked at the box, without moving his hand. "Well, well, well," he said. "Sometimes Christmas lasts a good while. Hey, Romeo?" Joe had moved a little away from the bureau. He had never been in the house before. He was looking at the man, with on his face an expression a little placative and baffled, though not alarmed, watching the man's inscrutable and monk-like face. But he said nothing. It was the waitress who said, "If you don't like it, you don't have to eat it." He watched Max, watching his face, hearing the waitress's voice. The voice down-looking, "Not doing you nor nobody else any harm. Not on his time." He was not watching her nor the blonde woman either. He was watching Max, with that expression puzzled, placative, not afraid. The blonde woman now spoke. It was as though they were speaking of him and in his presence and in a tongue which they knew that he did not know. "Come on out," the blonde woman said. "For sweet Jesus," Max said. "I was just going to give Romeo a drink on the house." "Does he want one?" the blonde woman said. Even when she addressed Joe directly, it was as if she still spoke to Max. "Do you want a drink?" "Don't hold him in suspense because of his past behavior. Tell him it's on the house." "I don't know," Joe said. "I never tried it." "Never tried anything on the house," Max said. "For sweet Jesus." He had not looked at Joe once again after he entered the room. Again, it was as if they talked at and because of him in a language which he did not understand. "Come on," the blonde woman said. "Come on now." They went out. The blonde woman had never looked at him at all, and the man, without looking at him, had never ceased. Then they were gone. Joe stood beside the bureau. In the middle of the floor, the waitress stood, down looking, with the open box of candy in her hand. The room was close, smelling of stale scent. Joe had never seen it before. He had not believed that he ever would. The shades were drawn. The single bulb burned at the end of a cord, shaded by a magazine page pinned about it and already turned brown from the heat. "It's all right," he said. "It's all right." She didn't answer nor move. He thought of the darkness outside, the night in which they had been alone before. "Let's go," he said. "Go," she said. Then he looked at her. "Go where?" she said. "What for?" Still, he did not understand her. He watched her come to the bureau and set the box of candy upon it. While he watched, she began to take her clothes off, ripping them off and flinging them down. He said, "Here?" "In here?" It was the first time he had ever seen a naked woman, though he had been her lover for a month. But even then he did not even know that he had not known what to expect to see. That night they talked. They lay in the bed, in the dark, talking. Or he talked, that is. All the time he was thinking, "Jesus, Jesus, so this is it." He lay naked too, beside her, touching her with his hand and talking about her. Not about where she had come from and what she had even done, but about her body, as if no one had ever done this before, with her or with anyone else. It was as if with speech he were learning about women's bodies, with the curiosity of a child. She told him about the sickness of the first night. It did not shock him now. Like the nakedness and the physical shape, it was like something which had never happened or existed before. So he told her in turn what he knew to tell. He told about the Negro girl in the mill shed on that afternoon 3 years ago. He told her quietly and peacefully, lying beside her, touching her. Perhaps he could not even have said if she listened or not. Then he said, "You noticed my skin, my hair," waiting for her to answer, his hand slow on her body. She whispered also, "Yes, I thought maybe you were a foreigner, that you never come from around here." "It's different from that, even. More than just a foreigner. You can't guess."
"What? How more different?"
"Guess." Their voices were quiet. It was still quiet. Night now known, not to be desired, pined for.
"I can't. What are you?"
His hand was slow and quiet on her invisible flank. He did not answer at once. It was not as if he were tantalizing her. It was as if he just had not thought to speak on. She asked him again, Then he told her.
I got some nigger blood in me.
Then she lay perfectly still, with a different stillness. But he did not seem to notice it. He lay peacefully too, his hands slow up and down her flank.
You're what? She said. I think I got some nigger blood in me.
His eyes were closed, his hands slow and unceasing.
I don't know. I believe I have.
She did not move. She said at once, You're lying.
All right, he said, not moving, his hand not ceasing.
I don't believe it,
her voice said in the darkness.
All right, he said, his hand not ceasing.
The next Saturday he took another half dollar from Mrs. McEachern's hiding place and gave it to the waitress. A day or two later he had reason to believe that Mrs. McEachern had missed the money and that she suspected him of having taken it. Because she lay in wait for him until he knew that she knew that McEachern would not interrupt them. Then she said, Joe. He paused and looked at her, knowing that she would not be looking at him. She said, not looking at him, her voice flat, level,
I know how a young man growing up needs money.
More than Mr.
McEachern gives you.
He looked at her until her voice ceased and died away. Apparently he was waiting for it to cease. Then he said,
Money? What do I want with money?
On the next Saturday, he earned $2 chopping wood for a neighbor. He lied to McEachern about where he was going and where he had been and what he had done there. He gave the money to the waitress. McEachern found out about the work. Perhaps he believed that Joe had hidden the money. Mrs. McEachern may have told him so. Perhaps two nights a week, Joe and the waitress went to her room. He did not know at first that anyone else had ever done that. Perhaps he believed that some peculiar dispensation had been made in his favor, for his sake. Very likely, until the last, he still believed that Max and Mame had to be placated, not for the actual fact, but because of his presence there. But he did not see them again in the house, though he knew that they were there. But he did not know for certain if they knew that he was there or had ever returned after the night of the candy. Usually they met outside, went somewhere else, or just loitered on the way to where she lived. Perhaps he believed up to the last that he had suggested it. Then one night she did not meet him where he waited. He waited until the clock in the courthouse struck 12. Then he went on to where she lived. He had never done that before, though even then he could not have said that she had ever forbidden him to come there unless she was with him. But he went there that night, expecting to find the house dark and asleep. The house was dark, but it was not asleep. He knew that, beyond the dark shades of her room, people were not asleep, and that she was not there alone. How he knew it, he could not have said. Neither would he admit what he knew. It's just Max, he thought. It's just Max. But he knew better. He knew that there was a man in the room with her. He did not see her for 2 weeks, though he knew that she was waiting for him. Then one night he was at the corner when she appeared. He struck her, without warning, feeling her flesh. He knew then what even yet he had not believed. Oh, she cried. He struck her again.
Not here, she whispered. Not here.
Then he found that he was crying. He had not cried since he could remember. He cried, cursing her, striking her. Then she was holding him. Even the reason for striking her was gone then.
Now, now. She said. Now, now.
They did not leave the corner even that night. They did not walk on loitering nor leave the road. They sat on a sloping grass bank and talked. She talked this time, telling him. It did not take much telling. He could see now what he discovered that he had known all the time. The idle men in the restaurant, with their cigarettes bobbing as they spoke to her in passing, and she going back and forth, constant, down-looking and abject. Listening to her voice, he seemed to smell the odor reek of all anonymous men above dirt. Her head was a little lowered as she talked, the big hands still on her lap. He could not see, of course. He did not have to see.
I thought you knew, she said.
No, he said. I reckon I didn't.
I thought you did.
No, he said. I don't reckon I did. 2 weeks later, he had begun to smoke, squinting his face against the smoke, and he drank, too. He would drink at night with Max and Mame, and sometimes three or four other men, and usually another woman or two, sometimes from the town, but usually strangers who would come in from Memphis and stay a week or a month, as waitresses behind the restaurant counter where the idle men gathered all day. He did not always know their names, but he could cock his hat as they did. During the evenings behind the drawn shades of the dining room at Max's, he cocked it so and spoke of the waitress to the others, even in her presence, in his loud, drunken, despairing young voice, calling her his whore. Now and then in Max's car he took her to dances in the country, always careful that McEachern should not hear about it. I don't know which he would be madder at, he told her. At you or at the dancing. Once they had to put him to bed, helpless, in the house where he had not even ever dreamed at one time that he could enter. The next morning the waitress drove him out home before daylight so he could get into the house before he was caught. And during the day McEachern watched him with dour and grudging approval. But you have still plenty of time to make me regret that heifer, McEachern said. Chapter 9. McEachern lay in bed. The room was dark, but he was not asleep. He lay beside Mrs. McEachern, whom he did believe to be sleeping, thinking fast and hard, thinking, the suit has been worn. But when? It could not have been during the day, because he is beneath my eyes, except on Saturday afternoons. But on any Saturday afternoon he could go to the barn, remove and hide the fit clothing which I require him to wear, and then don apparel which he would and could need only as some adjunct to sinning. It was as if he knew then, had been told. That would infer then that the garments were worn in secret, and therefore in all likelihood at night. And if that were so, he refused to believe that the boy had other than one purpose. Lechery. He had never committed lechery himself, and he had not once failed to refuse to listen to anyone who talked about it. Yet within about 30 minutes of intensive thinking, he knew almost as much of Joe's doings as Joe himself could have told him, with the exception of names and places. Very likely he would not have believed those even from Joe's mouth, since men of his kind usually have just as firmly fixed convictions about the mechanics, the theatering of evil, as about those of good. Thus, bigotry and clairvoyance were practically one, only the bigotry was a little slow, for as Joe, descending on his rope, slid like a fast shadow across the open and moon-filled window behind which McEachern lay, McEachern did not at once recognize him, or perhaps believe what he saw, even though he could see the very rope itself. And when he got to the window, Joe had already drawn the rope back and made it fast, and was now on his way toward the barn. As McEachern watched him from the window, he felt something of that pure and impersonal outrage which a judge must feel were he to see a man on trial for his life lean and spit on the bailiff's sleeve. Hidden in the shadows of the lane halfway between the house and the road, he could see Joe at the mouth of the lane. He too heard the car and saw it come up and stop and Joe get into it. Possibly he did not even care who else was in it. Perhaps he already knew, and his purpose had been merely to see in which direction it went. Perhaps he believed that he knew that too, since the car could have gone almost anywhere in a country full of possible destinations with roads that led to them. Because he turned now back toward the house, walking fast in that same pure and impersonal outrage, as if he believed so that he would be guided by some greater and purer outrage that he would not even need to doubt personal faculties. In carpet slippers, without a hat, his nightshirt thrust into his trousers and his braces dangling, he went straight as an arrow to the stable and saddled his big, old, strong white horse and returned back down the lane and to the road at a heavy gallop, though Mrs. McEachern from the kitchen door called his name when he rode out of the lot. He turned into the road at that slow and ponderous gallop, the two of them, man and beast, leaning a little stiffly forward as though in some juggernautish simulation of terrific speed, though the actual speed itself was absent, as if in that cold and implacable and undeviating conviction of both omnipotence and clairvoyance of which they both partook, known destination and speed were not necessary. He rode at that same speed straight to the place which he sought and which he had found out of a whole night and almost a whole half of a county, though it was not that far distant. He had gone hardly 4 miles when he heard music ahead, and then he saw beside the road lights in a schoolhouse, a one-room building. He had known where the building was, but he had had neither reason nor manner of knowing that there would be a dance held in it. But he rode straight to it and into the random shadows of parked cars and buggies and saddled horses and mules which filled the grove which surrounded the school, and dismounted almost before the horse had stopped. He did not even tether it. He got down, and in the carpet slippers and the dangling braces and his round head and his short, blunt, outraged beard, ran toward the open door and the open windows where the music came and where kerosene-lit shadows passed in a certain orderly uproar. Perhaps, if he were thinking at all, he believed that he had been guided and were now being propelled by some militant Michael himself as he entered the room. Apparently his eyes were not even momentarily at fault with the sudden light and the motion as he thrust among bodies with turned heads, as, followed by a wake of astonishment and incipient pandemonium, he ran toward the youth whom he had adopted of his own free will and whom he had tried to raise as he was convinced was right. Joe and the waitress were dancing, and Joe had not seen him yet. The woman had never seen him but once, but perhaps she remembered him, or perhaps his appearance now was enough, because she stopped dancing and upon her face came an expression very like horror, which Joe saw and turned. As he turned, McEachern was upon them. Neither had McEachern ever seen the woman but once, and very likely then he had not looked at her, just as he had refused to listen when men spoke of fornication. Yet he went straight to her, ignoring Joe for the moment. "Away, Jezebel," he said. His voice thundered into the shocked silence, the shocked surrounding faces beneath the kerosene lamps, into the ceased music, into the peaceful moonlit night of young summer. "Away, harlot!" Perhaps it did not seem to him that he had been moving fast, nor that his voice was loud.
Very likely he seemed to himself to be standing just and rock-like and with neither haste nor anger, while on all sides the sluttishness of weak human man seethed in a long sigh of terror about the actual representative of the wrathful and retributive throne. Perhaps they were not even his hands which struck at the face of the youth whom he had nurtured and sheltered and clothed from a child, and perhaps when the face ducked the blow and came up again, it was not the face of that child. But he could not have been surprised at that, since it was not that child's face which he was concerned with. It was the face of Satan, which he knew as well. And when, staring at the face, he walked steadily toward it with his hand still raised, very likely he walked toward it in the furious and dreamlike exaltation of a martyr who has already been absolved, into the descending chair which Joe swung at his head, and into nothingness. Perhaps the nothingness astonished him a little, but not much, and not for long. Then to Joe it all rushed away, roaring, dying, leaving him in the center of the floor, the shattered chair clutched in his hand, looking down at his adopted father. McEachern lay on his back. He looked quite peaceful now. He appeared to sleep, blunt-headed, indomitable, even in repose, even the blood on his forehead peaceful and quiet. Joe was breathing hard. He could hear it, and also something else, thin and shrill and far away. He seemed to listen to it for a long time before he recognized it for a voice, a woman's voice. He looked and saw two men holding her, and she writhing and struggling, her hair shaken forward, her white face wrung and ugly beneath the splotches of savage paint, her mouth a small jagged hole filled with shrieking. "Calling me a harlot," she screamed, wrenching at the men who held her. "That old son of a bitch! Let go! Let go!" Then her voice stopped making words again and just screamed. She writhed and threshed, trying to bite the hands of the men who struggled with her. Still carrying the shattered chair, Joe walked toward her. About the walls, huddling, clotted, the others watched him. The girls in stiff off-colors and mail-order stockings and heels. The men, young men in ill-cut and board-like garments also from the mail-order, with hard, ruined hands and eyes already revealing a heritage of patient brooding upon endless furrows and the slow buttocks of mules. Joe began to run, brandishing the chair. "Let her go," he said. At once she ceased struggling and turned on him the fury, the shrieking, as if she had just seen him, realized that he was also there. "And you. You brought me here. Goddamn bastard clodhopper. Bastard you. Son of a bitch, you and him too. Putting him at me that never ever saw—" Joe did not appear to be running at anyone in particular, and his face was quite calm beneath the uplifted chair. The others fell back from about the woman, freeing her, though she continued to wrench her arms as if she did not yet realize it. "Get out of here," Joe shouted. He whirled, swinging the chair, yet his face was still quite calm. "Back," he said, though no one had moved toward him at all. They were all as still and as silent as the man on the floor. He swung the chair, backing now toward the door. "Stand back. I said I would kill him someday. I told him so." He swung the chair about him, calm-faced, backing toward the door. "Don't a one of you move now," he said, looking steadily and ceaselessly at faces that might have been masks. Then he flung the chair down and whirled and sprang out the door into soft, dappled moonlight. He overtook the waitress as she was getting into the car in which they had come. He was panting, yet his voice was calm too.
a sleeping face merely breathing hard enough to make sounds.
"Get on back to town," he said. "I'll be there soon as I..."
Apparently he was not aware of what he was saying, nor of what was happening. When the woman turned suddenly in the door of the car and began to beat him in the face, he did not move. His voice did not change.
"Yes, that's right. I'll be there soon as I..."
Then he turned and ran, while she was still striking at him. He could not have known where McEachern had left the horse, nor for certain if it was even there. Yet he ran straight to it, with something of his adopted father's complete faith in an infallibility in events. He got onto it and swung it back toward the road. The car had already turned into the road. He saw the taillight diminish and disappear. The old, strong, farm-bred horse returned home at its slow and steady canter. The youth upon its back rode lightly, balanced lightly, leaning well forward, exulting perhaps at that moment as Faustus had, of having put behind now at once and for all the "shalt not," of being free at last of honor and law. In the motion the sweet, sharp sweat of the horse blew, sulfuric. The invisible wind flew past. He cried aloud, "I have done it! I have done it! I told them I would!" He entered the lane and rode through the moonlight up to the house without slowing. He had thought it would be dark, but it was not. He did not pause. The careful and hidden rope were as much a part of his dead life now as honor and hope. And the old, wearying woman who had been one of his enemies for 13 years and who was now awake, waiting for him. The light was in hers and McEachern's bedroom, and she was standing in the door with a shawl over her nightdress. "Joe," she said. He came down the hall fast. His face looked as McEachern had seen it as the chair fell. Perhaps she could not yet see it good.
"What is it?" she said. "Pa rode away on the horse. I heard..."
She saw his face then. But she did not even have time to step back. He did not strike her. His hand on her arm was quite gentle. It was just hurried, getting her out of the path, out of the door. He swept her aside as he might have a curtain across the door. "He's at a dance," he said. "Get away, old woman." She turned, clutching the shawl with one hand, her other against the doorface as she fell back, watching him as he crossed the room and began to run up the stairs which mounted to his attic. Without stopping, he looked back. Then she could see his teeth shining in the lamp. "At a dance, you hear? He's not dancing, though." He laughed back into the lamp. He turned his head and his laughing, running on up the stairs, vanishing as he ran, vanishing upward from the head down as if he were running head first and laughing into something that was obliterating him like a picture in chalk being erased from a blackboard. She followed, toiling up the stairs. She began to follow almost as soon as he passed her, as if that implacable urgency which had carried her husband away had returned like a cloak on the shoulders of the boy and had been passed from him in turn to her. She dragged herself up the cramped stair, clutching the rail with one hand and the shawl with the other. She was not speaking, not calling to him. It was as though she were a phantom obeying the command sent back by the absent master. Joe had not lighted his lamp, but the room was filled with refracted moon glow, and even without that, very likely she could have told what he was doing. She held herself upright by the wall, fumbling her hand along the wall until she reached the bed and sank onto it, sitting. It had taken her some time, because when she looked toward where the loose plank was, he was already approaching toward the bed, where the moonlight fell directly, and she watched him empty the tin can onto the bed and sweep the small mass of coins and bills into his hand and ram the hand into his pocket. Only then did he look at her as she sat, back fallen a little now, propped on one arm and holding the shawl with the other hand. "I didn't ask you for it," he said. "Remember that. I didn't ask because I was afraid you would give it to me. I just took it. Don't forget that." He was turning almost before his voice ceased.